La Càtedra Ferrater-Mor està extraordinàriament contenta de tenir Michael Nyman aquí. No havíem tingut encara cap músic durant tots aquests anys de la Càtedra Ferrater-Mor, i Ferrater mateix era un aficionat extraordinari a la música, de manera que estaria molt complagut de tenir aquí a Michael Nyman. Good morning. It's my honor and my pleasure to welcome you, Mr. Nyman, and to introduce you. The chair Ferrater-Mor is 17 years old, and you have invited and we have invited the most prominent thinkers and experts on all domains of contemporary culture. A musician was lacking. You are the first one we have invited. I'm sure that Ferrater-Mor himself would be extremely pleased to have you here, because he loved very much music, and he was to some extent an expert, though he was a philosopher. He liked very much music, so that for us it's really an achievement that you are here. We are very, very pleased. Thank you very much for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting.
Good morning. I write music and I play music, and I don't talk about it very much. I don't write about it very much. Can you hear me? Yes?
Yes, I know.
I mean, can you turn the microphone on, please? Hello? Can you hear me in the back or not? No?
No?
You have a headphone? I haven't touched it.
You need that.
No, you don't.
Sorry.
You told me.
John.
Yes or no? Can you hear me? No? Hello, technology. Need some assistance. So.
Hello, I'm here, you're there. So, I write music and I play the music that I write on occasion when I'm lucky, like last night. And I don't really talk about it very much, and I don't write about it very much, and the most difficult thing for me to do when I was asked to do this lecture, or two lectures, is to sit down and write a lecture. I can't do it. It takes too much time, and involves parts of my brain that no longer function. As you know, I mean, some of you have a copy of my book, Experimental Music, Cage and Beyond, which has just been brilliantly translated into Spanish and Catalan, and you will see from that once upon a time, when I was a young boy, a young man, I was able to write about music, and I was able to conceptualize, and I was able to be some kind of musical thinker. Now, I write music, and I think about writing music when I write it, and there's a lot of thought that goes into it, but I don't think about it in the sense that I can give an academic lecture. So we're not having an academic lecture. And I've given two appropriate or inappropriate subjects to talk about. One is composing for opera, and the other is composing for film. Basically, I'm going to be talking about the same thing. So the first lecture may be about composing for opera, when I should be talking about composing for film. Basically, all I want to do is to open up some things that I consider when I'm writing music, and not talk about big questions and big principles and whatever, but basically, since I'm here, I assume that what is interesting to you guys is the way that I do things, and the way that I kind of organize music, and the way that music organizes me, and the interesting thing about the connection between opera and film, I guess, is that both collaborations of some sort, so maybe these lectures are about collaborating. But another way of dealing with this, with these two lectures, is instead of me talking about what I want to talk about that may or may not be interesting to you, I would be very curious to know what you want to know from me. So, you know, some one of you may have a question about how one becomes a film composer, how one is able to simultaneously be the master of one's work, but yet the servant of another artist, which of course is a big problem with writing film music. So, before I start, it is possible that these two lectures could just be a question and answer session, and all the CDs and DVDs that I have here that you can find anywhere can be left unplayed, and we just talk about what you want to know from me. Now, does anyone want to know anything before I start? No? I mean, how many of you came to the concert last night? All right, okay. Fine. Okay. So, an interesting aspect of that concert was the fact that every piece of music that I played last night was film music. And most of the music that you heard, you would not have heard in that particular form in a film soundtrack. And when I started my record label, MN Records, I thought, young men, please, I'm talking. Please. You have the rest of your lives to talk together. I'm here for an hour. I write all my music at the piano, and it then gets orchestrated generally by me for other instruments, a string quartet, an orchestra, the Michael Nyman Band. But everything that you hear that I compose starts in the form that you heard it last night as a piece of piano music. And obviously what I write depends on what sort of pianist I am. I became a certain kind of pianist because of my response to certain kinds of musical material. So there's a kind of constant kind of dialectic between who I am as a pianist, which affects the way that I write my music, and who I am as a composer, that affects the way that I write the music. And it seems that I have two musical characters, two extremes. I have an extreme, which is Michael Nyman, the melodist, which I'm extremely happy. I'm very happy to be a melodist. I don't think there's enough melody in the world, not enough sophisticated melody. But I'm also ashamed of being a melodist, because you know, contemporary music is not supposed to be about melody. It's meant to be about construction. It's meant to be about systems. It's meant to be about processes. It's not meant to be a kind of force for entertainment. So that's a kind of paradox. And so that there is Michael Nyman, the composer of slow, sweet melodies, which I enjoy doing and I think I'm very good at, and people obviously respond emotionally to these melodies. But there is also when you see my other performing persona, which is when I play with the Michael Nyman Band, which is the kind of, let's say, a more aggressive kind of pianist. And I discovered this more aggressive side of piano playing, and therefore an aggressive side of composing, when I first started writing, again, seriously, 30 years ago in 1976. I spend a lot of my energies recomposing other composers' music, recycling. This was before postmodernism, but there's a sense in which I was a postmodernist before the term was coined. And I found a particular piece of Mozart that the first 16 measures of the catalogue song from In Re Don Giovanni, and it has very nice, the strings are playing, and the etc. I'm sure you're very familiar with it. Leporello. I first heard that when I was about 10 or 11 years old, and I always loved it, and I remembered it. And 20 years later, when I needed to write a piece of music for a concert, I thought, I don't want to invent my own material, I will refer back to Mozart. So I looked at this score and I saw nice string writing, nice 18th century string writing, and I sat down and I played it like this. That kind of discovery, and the interesting thing is that at the moment immediately before sitting down with that music and transforming it into something that it wasn't, I wasn't that pianist. So it's not as though I'd always been a kind of rock and roll pianist, and I just wanted to find a way of being a rock and roll pianist and a composer simultaneously. I literally discovered my musical language and a way of making rather aggressive, rhythmic, pulsing music, literally through Mozart. I mean, this was—it's one of those accidents that you want to happen every day. But they don't. But on the other hand, it was a very happy accident, because in fact it transformed my whole life, because I then became the composer who, for half of his time, when he's not playing, when I'm not playing that kind of music, I'm playing that. So through the necessity of writing a piece of music, through my recollection of that music when I heard it as a child, and through the very material that Mozart gave me. I mean, he didn't give it to me, because I made a choice, and within that choice there were various articulatory elements that became very attractive to me, and as I say, that I had articulated in a very, very personal way. That is the way that I became a composer. And it's kind of interesting that I'm not saying that at any point in my life I would have become the composer of that music, because I was obviously, in the late 60s and early 70s, I was obviously part of a musical culture in England, which where we had our own kind of brand of minimalism, which very much was very different from American minimalism in the sense that it did make an attempt to look at the music of the past and to represent it, to reconfigure it, to recycle it. So my thinking was obviously influenced by the music that I've been listening to as a listener and as a music critic. So when I rediscovered this piece of Mozart, it wasn't as though I was inventing something from an absolutely new virgin cultural position. I was already in a culture that kind of influenced the way that I would take a piece of music by Mozart and choose to recycle it. But as I say, once I've made that decision, the material that was in that piece, those very simple repeated eighth notes, changed my life. And so I don't know how many of you guys are composers, and if you ask me how you would become a composer, I would say I really don't know, and then I would tell you this story, and you could either say, yes, I need to find a piece of Mozart to recycle, or etc., etc. But what we're talking about is I was 32 years old when I discovered this piece of Mozart, and I'd spent the previous sort of 5 or 6 or 7 years, as I say, working within a particular musical cultural context where we had rejected Stockhausen and Boulez, and we had discovered Cage and Steve Reich and whatever. So there are a lot of kind of ideas in the air. And, you know, again, if I was giving a composition seminar, the whole point is that you accept the ideas that are in the air, but you put your personal imprint on them. Now, it's very difficult to do that. It's something that comes instinctively. So instinctively, what I did with the Mozart was to start playing it like that. And then the way that I structured the piece was in Mozart's texture, there's this, there's a bass part, and there's a violin part. Or whatever. And then there is Leporello's melody. And again, within the kind of formal processes of the time, what I did was not a simple arrangement, but was to take each of these four elements and to expose them one at a time. So first of all, you take away and expose as an individual textual component this. And then you keep that going and you add this. And then you add, if I don't have three hands, and then you add. So that's the third cycle. And then the fourth cycle, you've got those three things going, which are in the string orchestra. And then the fourth element. So you have one plus one plus one plus one. So you have four elements. And once all these elements are exposed, each is played twice, the piece ends. I mean, I could have played them three times, could have played them four times, could have played them once. So a kind of instinctive sense of how to create a piece of music was brought into play. Now, the interesting thing, the background to this is that, you know, when I was 18 to 21, I was a composer from 1961 to 64, and then in 1964 I stopped composing, and I didn't compose anything for 12 years. And when I came back as a composer, obviously the kind of music that I'd listened to, my interests, and as I say, the cultural context in which I found myself was totally different from the one that I'd left in 1964. So there was no sense of continuity, and there was no sense that what I was composing in 1964 had any relevance to what I started composing in 1976. And as I say, the way that I composed in 1976 was partly conditioned by my memory, partly conditioned by the composer that I was when I was a student, but as I say, very much conditioned by what other composers were doing at the time. But I managed, because I was old, 32, I somehow managed to create instantly a kind of Michael Nyman sound, which was useful to the public. Obviously, suddenly there was this new sound in the world, but more interestingly was useful to me, because it then gave me a kind of instant language, an instant kind of way of processing material, and also gave me something which wasn't very original, which was repeated eighth notes. And I think I may... don't have the piece. But what I was going to talk about, which was not really that... Do we have that? Is that piece on the... Excuse me, let me just... Since I've talked about it, it might be nice to... Is In Re Don Giovanni on that? No, it's not on there. Did I give you another? No, it's not on there. No, it's not there. No. Sorry. Does anyone have any questions yet? I feel as though I'm a... I don't have a recording. I feel like I'm one of those television shopping salespeople. You know, I'm walking around, I have one of these, and this will cost you 37 euros, and we have one of those. So I've never done this before. So I can't play you that piece. But what it did do was... if you play track one of that, track one, yeah. It did, since I'm supposed to be talking about film music, it did suggest to Peter Greenaway, when he came to write the Draftsman's Contract, it suggested to Peter Greenaway that somehow... No, stop. Haven't got there yet. Sorry. When he was writing the Draftsman's Contract, and this is something that not many people know, he used this piece, which I called In Re Don Giovanni, which is quite a clever title, because it's Don Giovanni, it comes from Don Giovanni. It comes from Leporello's song, which is about Don Giovanni and his thousands of women conquests. In Re also obviously is a legal term, which means it's about Don Giovanni. And of course, it's in the key of D. So quite clever. So Peter Greenaway heard this piece and realized... and he possibly would have realized this anyway, that it is possible to make a piece of art that is simultaneously in two different historical contexts. It's kind of trans-historical. So In Re Don Giovanni, when you listen to it, and I can't play it to you because I don't have it, obviously is a piece of 18th century music, but the way that I have remade it, the way that I've recycled it, obviously it was something to do with the late 20th century. And that indicated to Greenaway that it was possible to make a film like The Draftsman's Contract, which, when you look at it, obviously is totally concerned with presenting ideas that appear to be to do with the late 17th century. The whole feel of the film, the look of the film, the references in the film are purely historical and completely historical, but the resonances and the issues that he wanted to expose in the film are very much to do with the 1980s, which have to do with relationships and have to do with politics and have to do with the politics of exploitation, with doing things for, you know, kind of commercial deals between human beings, rather heartless Thatcherite deals. So that piece in Ray Don Giovanni was very crucial in helping Greenaway to overcome a problem that had to do with a film being stuck in its historical period. And on a more specific level, when we talked about the soundtrack for The Draftsman's Contract, we obviously agreed that music would be the music from the period when the film was set. So it would be English music from the 1690s. And since I had been a musicologist, obviously knew the music of Purcell very well, and I said it has to be Purcell. And basically the model that I'd used with In Re Don Giovanni using Mozart then became a kind of model for what I could do with Purcell's music in The Draftsman's Contract, except that this is not meant to be a lecture about found objects, but when you find a musical object, or any artist finds an object, it strikes me there are two very, very simple processes. One is what you as an artist learn from the object itself, and the other is what you apply to the object. And then there's a kind of, again, a dialogue, a dialectic between the two. So with the Mozart piece, at that point, I discovered certain things to do with that material, and the material told me certain things that I could do with it. And the material that I chose from Purcell told me certain other things, and I also imposed my information on the Purcell material. And the interesting thing about In Re Don Giovanni is that when you listen to it, and you can't listen to it because I don't have it, is the way that material is presented in In Re Don Giovanni is very specific. But I have, over the years, when I've been, when I've not had the imagination to invent my own chord sequences, I have constantly reverted to the Mozart material as a source of harmonic ideas, and I possibly will, put together a whole CD of material that I've derived from the catalog song, and the character of every piece is very different, but still. So, with The Draftsman's Contract, I had the model of this In Re Don Giovanni, I had Greenaway's instructions to use late 17th century music, my idea to take music from Purcell, and then the first and most popular piece of music that came out of this collaboration for The Draftsman's Contract is this piece called Chasing Sheep is Best Left to Shepherds, which in which you obviously and very deliberately hear a lot of the repeated eighth notes of In Re Don Giovanni. So here was a situation of a composer having discovered his voice through Mozart, discovered a way of articulating a personal musical language, developing this musical language, and taking it to the next stage, so that, you know, we all have the problem as composers, as artists, as to creating our own voice, which people want to hear and want to be familiar with. And it's very kind of comfortable if you're a composer to say, this is how I do things, this is what I want to do, you're familiar with this, I'm familiar with this process, I will write another piece in the same style as the previous piece, because that's what I expect of myself and that's what the public expects. But also you'd like to move ahead and to do new things and new ways of looking at your old processes and new ways of totally moving away from these old processes. So if we play Chasing Sheep, you'll hear how close it is to the Mozart, which you haven't heard, but also, I hope, how distant it is as well. Thank you. Okay, so that's kind of interesting to me because what I was saying about developing a musical language and then extending it through repetition or through self-parody, the origin of this piece is a Purcell piece from somewhere. Whatever, quite a slow piece and a gentle piece. And I've taken some of the melodic language and generally the almost exclusively built that piece of music out of the harmonies. Also could be rock and roll, and towards the end, in like the fourth or fifth section where the music goes fast, obviously what I've done is to take the, I mean almost literally transpose this into this. So that's what I was saying about, you know, inventing your own style and then repeating it or developing it or whatever. But the structure of this piece is very interesting, and I'll probably spend the rest of however long we have, talking about the Draftsman's Contract. Okay, so that's a piece of music that appears to be a coherent piece of music. It starts with four repeats of similar kind of material, then there's a slow section, and then there's a tune. And then you go into this section, etc., 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 and then the piece ends. So it seems to be a coherent piece of music that kind of breaks some of the rules of minimalism, because minimalism at that time when I wrote that piece, even in the early 80s, was a smooth process. You start with an idea and it changes a little, but the dynamic of a piece doesn't change. Now this piece starts in one tempo, goes into another tempo, goes into another kind of material, another tempo, and then returns to its original tempo. Now, you should ask yourself how I made those decisions. And the answer is that I didn't make those decisions consciously. That this is a piece of music which is a collage, a montage, an edit of four or five, or maybe more, sequences from the soundtrack to the film that I have kind of put together in a particular order to make a satisfying concert piece that does this, and then does this, and then does that. And the background, we come to the kind of the crux of what I want to, the one thing I want to say about being a film composer that is a source of joy and a source of frustration is working with Peter Greenaway was unlike working with any other filmmaker. Almost every film that I've made with other directors, there's been a script, there's been a film, and there's been a discussion between me and the filmmaker where they say, here's a sequence, we need a certain kind of music, here's a sequence that does such and such a thing, we need another kind of music. The way of working with Peter Greenaway was much more speculative, much more conceptual, had to do more with structure and a reference system than it did with emotion. So He never gave me a film that I responded to as a composer, because quite often I wrote the music before he made the film or while he was making it, and then these two artifacts were brought together. So the Draftsman's Contract, the story is that a rich man who owns a big house invites to come to his house a draftsman, someone who makes drawings, and he's commissioned to make drawings of the house. Now, when you see the film, obviously there's a whole kind of drama built around the drawings and the reason for making the drawings, and it has to do with the evidence that is found in the drawings, which has to do with a kind of Agatha Christie kind of plot. But what the communication between the director and the composer was very, very simple. There are 12 drawings. Each drawing should have its own piece of music. Not in order to express the drawing, but just in order to identify it. So every time you heard music like this, you realized that this identified the first drawing. Now, the drawings were made, and this is very academic, but it's actually very interesting. The drawings were made in two sets of six. So there were six drawings made in the first 3 days, six drawings made in the second 3 days. Each drawing was of a particular location, and each drawing made at that location was made at a particular time of day. So the drawing that I attached this music to was drawing made, I can't remember, in a field at 6 o'clock in the morning, right? And since each drawing was built up by the draftsman, by the artist, over a period of 6 days, you were aware as an audience that you were being given more, you know, on each time you saw the drawing, there was more detail. So the first time you saw the drawing, maybe there's just a few lines, and then the following day, there's a bit more detail, and then the following day, there may be even more detail, and also somebody might walk into the frame, etc., etc. So, as a composer, what excited me about this was not merely recycling 17th century music, but since the way that I write music, as we discovered from the Mozart, was very much to have that kind of material, and then you add something, and then you add something, and then you add something. So it's a bit like pop music. It's a bit like, you know, my music is generally kind of created in the form of a layer. So you have a bass part, and then you have a backing track, and then you may put down, I mean, in pop terms, you may put down a lead guitar and then the vocal. So kind of interestingly, the way that I wrote music instinctively in this kind of moment of discovery with the Mozart piece was an analogy with the way that the pop music was recorded in a 24-track or a 16-track or an 8-track studio. You don't have the whole pop group in the studio at the same time with an orchestra and with the singers. You basically lay down one line at a time. And there's this new Beatles album which has just been produced by George Martin, which takes a lot of those elements that have become part of a recording and takes them apart, because you can take them apart because they were all recorded on separate tracks, and it sort of recycles and re-edits a lot of familiar Beatles material together in a totally different way. But that's it. So I like writing music which not only creates things in layers, but also is to do with fairly traditional variation form. So I take, I mean, with 17th, 18th, 19th century variations, you have a harmonic, you have a fixed harmony, and you use your imagination to create as many kind of points of differentiation within that same harmony as you can do. So if you look at something like the Bach Chaconne in D minor, basically what you're hearing is the same harmony in every variation, but Bach uses his ingenuity constantly to pull as far away from that harmony as possible while still staying within something which is recognizably his harmonic sequence. So instinctively, again, this is the way that I write a lot of my music. So for Peter Greenaway to say to me, I want a piece of music for each drawing which you hear in six different forms, just as there are, you know, just as you see the drawing in six days of growth, of development. So I did exactly the same thing with music. So I took that basic harmonic sequence and I made a musical analogy, a compositional analogy, with the sense of gradually increasing the amount of musical information in the way that the draftsman and the director gradually increase the visual information of these drawings. And the process was supposed to be that the simplest version, which might be this, which you heard after about 1.5 minutes of the piece, that was the music that would be added to the initial sketches, and then a slightly more evolved version, maybe this, would be the music that will go with the drawing on the third day, and this, or whatever, would be the music that goes with the fifth day, and then the whole process would be completed by the most elaborate version, which is this version. And so you would get the sense of visual accumulation, and you would get the sense of musical accumulation. Now, I was very innocent and naive and sincere, and I presented all this material to Peter Greenaway. And it was Peter Greenaway, you know, it's his kind of way of thinking that dictated this process of working. This was something, it was a process of working which I felt very comfortable with, but basically he dictated to me 12 drawings, 12 pieces of music. Each piece of music would evolve from almost a blank page, which could just be the bass line, to something more complicated. As I say, this gave me a lot of scope as a composer. So I give him the score, and he starts putting the music with the picture. And the first time, I mean, I could find this on the DVD, but it's easy just to talk about it. The first time that you see the draftsman and his assistant walking around the house and deciding which position he takes to make which drawing takes place, as I say, 6 o'clock in the morning, and there are sheep and there's mist and there's fog. And what I thought as a composer, naively, would be the music that would be added to this first sequence would be this very simple, gentle, sort of unarticulated music, you know. Or whatever. And instead of which, Peter Greenaway, from being the kind of conceptualizer, then becomes an audience. So he becomes like the rest of you. You listen to a piece of music, and this piece of music, however it's written, whatever the dynamics of it, whatever the reason for its existence, it has some kind of effect on you as an audience. And you say, oh yes, this piece reminds me of something, or this piece brings out a certain kind of emotion, or whatever. So he listens to these six pieces, academically, very interesting. And then when he hears this piece, which was the most evolved form of this material, and was meant to kind of glorify and to represent the completed drawing, he said, oh, that would be a perfect piece of music to have for this opening sequence on the very, very first day, when the draftsman has not made a single mark on his paper. And I think, you know, if we look at the film, it worked extremely well, because you've come from a big kind of interior sequence where people are telling stories. It's a kind of cocktail party, a 17th century cocktail party. So this has been very dark and, you know, lit like Georges de la Tour by candles. And you suddenly come out into this English countryside, and the most appropriate way of representing this countryside scene and the light and the open air, etc., etc., the natural daylight, is with the wrong piece of music, or the piece of music that has been taken out of its sequence, and he's used it simply because, as a filmmaker, the music that I wrote, that I kind of got to through these six processes, was the most appropriate for, conventionally, for that sequence. So here is this is a kind of lesson that I learned very early on, and any of you that write film music, that have the good fortune or the bad fortune to write film music, will realize that it's actually a very, very approximate art form, and that the basic decisions about what the music should do and where it is used are decisions that are made by the filmmaker. So even with a director as conceptual, as I say, as Peter Greenaway, who you would think would want to preserve the purity of the idea behind the soundtrack, which related structurally and in terms of process with the way that the drawings were made, rather than with what is conventionally called, I don't know what it's called, but what you conventionally see, you have a scene and you have a piece of music, and the piece of music emphasizes what's in the scene, reinforces it, you know, increases the kind of emotional content. You know, suddenly, from being very conceptual, he becomes almost kind of inarticulate and just uses the music that is the most suitable piece of illustrative music for the processes of illustration, even though if you talk to him theoretically about what he would want a soundtrack to do, he would say, the last thing I want the soundtrack to do is to be illustrative. So here was I, you know, this was the first feature film that I ever composed for. I mean, before that we'd done about 6 or 8 short films together, but not a feature film, suddenly confronted with something where my Puritan attachment to the conceptual ethos was immediately kind of thrown out of the window by a non-illustrative director using the music in a purely illustrative way. But when I then, and I'll talk a bit more about this afternoon, that music that he used for the very first day of this film, because it came about through a certain process of writing the 6 different versions, would possibly not have happened if he hadn't given me the structural discipline of having to make 6 versions of the same thematic material. So that's a kind of interesting story, I think. So there must be some questions. Yes.
What you say, I infer that what we maybe call discretion doesn't play a role in your way of working. I mean, I understand that you work on analysis or knowledge of the past culture, the combination of the position on canvas. I think that a lot of young people here who probably believe that discretion is something that falls into your hands.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, I've been accused in the past of being a composer who only makes music based on other people's music. Now, there was a period in my life in the late 70s and early 80s. When a lot of my music was based on pre-existing material, less and less now. But I think there are two forms of inspiration. There's the inspiration of invention, so that something like this that I played last night. That came from nowhere, except a combination of this and this. But you could say that what I did with those 16 measures of the catalog song from Don Giovanni was, in a way, maybe more inspired than, creating my own musical ideas. You know, all composers create their own musical ideas. That particular sequence from Don Giovanni has been played hundreds of thousands of times and has been listened to by hundreds of composers and millions of people in the audience. I'm the only person, as far as I know, who actually said, stop. Let's freeze what is there, let's observe what is there, let me analyze what is there, let me re-articulate it, let me turn it into something else. Now, we could have a kind of philosophical argument collectively, I hope we don't, but we could do, as to whether, you know, which is the more inspired. Am I more inspired to write a simple tune? You know, we could discuss whether that is more inspired than In Re Don Giovanni. So, yeah, because the interesting thing is that you know, I was trained my training is as an academic, so all the things that academics do, harmony and counterpoint, musical analysis, you know, were part of my upbringing. So obviously I'm very aware of the way that classical music is put together. And what I decided with coming back to the Draftsman's Contract was that, again, by analogy, and this whole question of verbal, visual, literary, arithmetic analogies and music, I think, is very interesting. So here I was with the Draftsman's Contract. The draftsman was making drawings. The drawings were on pieces of paper of a certain size. So everything was kind of framed. So I decided that a musical analogy to the frame of the drawing is a harmonic sequence which is constantly repeating itself. So, as I say, variation forms in Baroque music were based on ground basses. So, the material goes round and round and round and round. It repeats itself. It contains its own frame. And what I, as the composer, do is constantly add extra layers, as I say, a bit like pop music. What was I saying? Where did that come from? So, you know, I've had two lives. I've had three lives as a musician. I was a musicologist, I was a music critic, and now I'm a composer. Maybe a fourth career as a lecturer, but, you know, maybe on the evidence of this, we should forget about the fourth career. What is interesting is that in my life, and this, you know, I think everything you do, you know, talking to students as, you know, kind of creative, potentially creative people, is that everything you do, if you become an artist of some sort or you become creative, everything you do, everything you've listened to, everywhere you've been, everything you've seen and heard is kind of fed into how you want to be and who you are as an artist. And in my case, it's been very simple in a way that when I was a musicologist, I studied the works of Henry Purcell, and the works of Henry Purcell that I studied were the repetitive forms, you know, were these ground basses. And I was doing that as an academic. I then subsequently discover minimalism, and minimalism is to do with systems and repetition. And I discover pop music, which also has to do with, you know, if you listen to the Beatles, all you hear is the same harmony kind of constantly recycled. I started writing music at a very, very interesting kind of personal, from a very interesting personal point of view, this kind of conjunction between Baroque harmony and repetition and variation, and repetition and difference, I suppose, at a time when composers were creating a totally different form of musical repetition and creating a sense of sameness or difference. Depends how you listen to minimalism, whether you listen to a minimal piece of music for what doesn't change or for what does change. At a time, you know, when I became very aware that pop music also dealt with these same kind of harmonic repeating constructs, at the same time as composers of my generation in England were taking a piece of music from the past and breaking it down into its constituent parts and building it up again. And then again, the process, as I say, the process of recording pop music, which is a process of layering one musical component on top of another and building up a kind of synthetic texture. I mean, a lot of these were kind of unconscious recognitions, but everything kind of fed into what I do. And then, as I say, you accept all those gifts, and you either accept them passively or you accept them actively, and you try and make something new, and you try and, if you establish a kind of a formula, you can both use that formula and also break the formula, which I think, I mean, for me, is the only reason for writing music, is constantly to break the formula. How are we doing for time? Oh, we're over time. So, are there anyone have any questions? Yes.
That here is a whole more or less you wrote in dressing up or changing metaphor and what you used to. You know that previous that here is that you want to form the general principle of simplicity.
Well, I mean, it's kind of interesting. I mean, I could make out a case that intellectually and culturally, In Re Don Giovanni is a very, very complex piece of music because it actually refers simultaneously to, you know, we could make out, you know, we could actually sit down between us and we may say there are, you know, it refers to four different sets of things, and you may say, well, it also refers to this and it also relates to that. So intellectually, you could say this is a very kind of complex construct, but as a piece of music, it is very simple. And what is interesting is that it's that I wrote that article on against the intellectual complexity of music in 1976, and I delivered it as a paper at a conference about the new simplicity, and it was in Berlin, and there were a number of composers invited, and of course there are only two out of the sort of 10 or 15 composers, you know, 12 of them were the most complex composers in the world, and two, Steve Reich and me, were the, you know, represented the new simplicity. And at one point I got really fed up with all this discussion of complexity, and I played a very rough recording of In Re Don Giovanni, you know, which lasted about two and a half minutes. And I noticed that after let's say 30 seconds, all these kind of complex, all these complexity specialists were kind of looking at their watches and scratching their heads and, you know, instructing the operator to turn the music off. And that was that was something that I felt very strong about, and I felt that there was a certain sense of power in this piece of music because actually it did express what the conference was supposed to express. But as I say, it is possible, you know, to have a kind of conceptual music where the concepts are, as I say, very complex, but the musical result is very simple without being simple-minded. Because, I mean, this is the other thing, you see. You know, I think complex music can be very simple-minded, even though it's complex. And the reception of a simple piece of music that presents the musical material very simply, the responses can be culturally and musically and emotionally and structurally quite complex. But it also has a lot to do with instinct. I mean, I don't sit down when I when I write music at 9 o'clock in the morning, I don't sit down and deliberately do something which is against intellectual complexity in music. Basically, I instinctively write something, and sometimes it becomes more complex because the textures are more complex, or because the demands of the context are more complex, and sometimes I leave it as a very simple tune because that's the best way to express the essence of the music. And also, obviously, if you're writing film music, I tend to stick to music that is really quite simple, because you are, and this is the last thing I would say about film music, because you are adding to and fighting with, and it's the fighting with that's the problem, you're fighting with a lot of distractions, visual distractions, oral distractions. So that's why I come up with a piece of music like... because that kind of cuts through whatever the complexity of the film is, and basically says, okay, if you want to express a love, you know, if you want to express love in music, which I don't like doing, but I was asked to, then this is the most direct and severe and simple form of doing it. So, as I say, the intellectually complex is not something that I avoid. I mean, just instinctively as a composer, I don't do it. But I can show you in my marimba concerto, for instance, or in some of the operas that I might play this afternoon, that there are degrees of complexity, or rather degrees of simplicity. I don't know. We'll have to talk about it. Okay, fine.
When do you feel that you are really following your musical language?
Yeah, this is a very interesting question, because the wonderful thing about, in my book, I think I quote, John Cage has this wonderful thing where he says, composing is one thing, performing is another thing, and listening is another thing. What do these three things have to do with each other? And I think this is a kind of fundamental question that we should ask ourselves all the time. And as a composer, what I've showed to you is that my concerns as a composer are with the abstract manipulation of material. As you pointed out, when I take a ground bass or I take a piece of Mozart, I analyze what's there, I work out how it's possible to restructure this. What doesn't concern me is what is being expressed by what I do. So I find this on the page, and I transform it into this. And until I hear it, I don't think about what I've created. I think about the process of creation, and then I sit back as a kind of member of the audience, obviously a very interested member of the audience, and I say, wow, I have created a piece of music that does such and such a thing. I'm still very aware when I listen to it of where it came from and what my thought processes were and how I manipulated material. But being a kind of child of John Cage and a child of minimalism, interestingly enough, you know, we weren't really concerned about the effect of what we did. You know, if you read Steve Reich, you know, if you read music as a gradual process, then all he's talking about is taking material and creating a formula whereby this music will repeat itself and change and develop, and then you get to the end of the process and you've heard everything he's done as a composer. You know, it's a bit like a fugue. You listen to a Bach fugue, and you either listen to it in close up, you take the theme, and you follow the process, or whatever, or you listen to the music without any awareness, without any focus on the process, and you just listen to this wonderful body of sound that has been created by an artist, you know, making individual decisions within a kind of process, which of course influence the way the music sounds and influence the way that you hear the music. And the other thing that comes into this, obviously, is you listen to that Bach fugue played by 50 different pianists, and your reaction to it changes according to whether it's Glenn Gould or Daniel Barenboim or whatever. And, you know, I've just been reading books about music theory and analysis and whatever, and what this analysis plays with. It plays with the manipulation of notes by the composer and the formulation of patterns and relationships, but it doesn't actually have to do with the process of performing what is being analyzed and receiving that performance. And to me as a composer, I mean, I've sometimes been absolutely shocked by what I thought a piece of music represented, and then listening to it and thinking, my God, you know, what have I created? I've created this. I remember when I wrote the music for Drowning by Numbers, and this was a very kind of academic project. The instruction from Peter Greenaway was that all the music had to be based on from the slow movement from the Mozart Sinfonia Concertante, and so I did that as a purely academic process of creating a set of variations that were interesting to me. And there's a wonderful tune. Which last night, so, you know, theme and variations. And I remember I recorded this, I had a mix. I went to a hotel, I was on holiday in Naples, and I just was listening to this cassette. And I was just kind of, I was, as we say, blown away by what I created through these kind of rather intellectual processes. And then for the first time, I listened to the music not from the point of view of the process, not from the point of view of creating something for the film, but just from the point of view of listening as a listener. And I was almost in tears because I created something that was so unexpectedly beautiful. But if you ask me, as film directors do, to create beautiful music, then I find that really difficult. So there's a lot of music that I've written that could be used, let's say, as love music, or that expresses some kind of familiar human emotion. And the most successful of that music is what happens accidentally, filtered through the process of composing, when I have to sit down and, you know, consciously, the task is consciously to create music that has a particular mood. I find it very difficult, which is very strange, a very strange admission for a film composer to make, because that's what we do. That's what we have to do, except in, with Greenaway, where process is more important. You know, basically, I do have to sit down and write music that, that supports and expresses and complements what you see on the screen. So,
would you accept that you tell the piano what to do, but that the piano tells you what you've done?
Yeah, yes. I mean, since that's very good, because I have a as I compose at the piano, I have a particular physical relationship with this instrument, and the combination of what my hands do, and what my brain does, and whatever, wherever the seat of aesthetic sense is, what all those things do, and I like doing. That's the paradox.
I think that's
okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, right. One more. Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
Just a question.
Can you tell me what you've done with your books? I'm a clear zero. Yeah. Would you? She sent for a lot of the buildings to the music players. You have to write about the door.
Do can computers help you to deconstruct, so to speak?
No. Quite interesting. I use computers to do exactly the opposite. So,
what's the opposite?
Well, I work in a program called Logic. Right, which is a program where I set up my computer, I have a MIDI keyboard, and I just play. So when I write music on the page, it's a slow process of constructing. When I play into the computer, it's as close as I would ever get to improvising. So I don't stop, I don't... I'm very unconsidered, and then I may play a piece for 4 or 5 minutes, and then I take it off the computer and I print it, and then I observe it. So I don't use the computer to do the analysis. It's still my brain and my musical instincts that do the analysis, but the computer is there as a kind of sophisticated recording machine to enable me to play music that comes from a combination of instinct and my keyboard playing. And I can play some things this afternoon that I've written in that way, and it enables me, so the computer enables me to get further away from the kind of this very conscious kind of considering part of what I'm doing.
It's just a first draft?
Yeah, it's a first draft. I then print it, I then make corrections, I then edit it, it becomes an object that I then observe. But what I've created is something that I don't think I would have created by anything other than performance. So it is a strange combination of instinctive performance and then the kind of intellectual analysis and then the kind of process of recomposition. And I find that really thrilling, really, because sometimes you make mistakes, or there are accidents, or there are places where your conscious brain doesn't normally go. Because when I'm writing music on the page, I'm always thinking, yes, I really like the sound of this, this is a kind of logical chord progression, this is very much within my my framework of reference and my taste, you know, my taste system. But when I'm just playing, sometimes your taste system is overridden just by sheer instinct. And then you say, I don't like the sound of that. But then you can also, you know, manipulate, you know, obviously in a computer you can change individual notes, so I can create things. But it's very, see, this is a very interesting process that has more to do, because I also take a lot of photographs. And this has more, as a closer process, as a closer analogy to taking photographs. And I maybe like to show you a photograph that I took yesterday in Paris as a kind of analogy to what I'm talking about. And it's basically, you know, photography for me is the kind of recognition and discovery partly of something that exists, but mostly of something that is unknown. And one of the problems with writing music is, to me, there's too much that is known, and there's not enough that is unknown, whereas one photograph, accidentally sometimes, a bit like playing into the computer, creates a world of the unknown, which is rather thrilling. I will show you this afternoon.
We continue this afternoon.